The middle of the week and plenty on the radio, from a head-to-head on planning and housing, slang and the Irish turn of phrase, and woe is to Invarna, some Americans, as luck would have it, want an Irish spouse. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
They reckon 1 million women in Britain threw their HRT tablets out.
Overnight. They stopped overnight.
Crazy. Yeah.
Why is it so important to get a real birth certificate?
It's almost like a recognition that you're a real person.
Everyone now knows that he was totally innocent. He wasn't a gunman. He was a good man going out to help another wounded person and waving a white flag.
And let's start here on the live line. Dr. Deirdre Lundy was Joe's guest, and she was trying to give some hope and information to many, many women going through the menopause.
As you know now, for over a week, we've been talking, generated by our calls, about the menopause. On Thursday night, stroke Friday morning, we were contacted by Dr. Deirdre Lundy, who was on the programme. Not enough on Friday. She was on the phone and she was addressing some of the issues. Now, she can't answer specific questions about patients, but she will do general issues, because Deirdre is now in studio with me. We're in the biggest studio in the place, and we are socially distant. And Deirdre, have you heard every programme?
Yeah. I listen to all of them. I listen back to all of them.
And what's your general sense?
It just reminds me of a day in the office, to be honest with you. Yeah. You know, the poor women, like, there's so many people who are not being helped, who could easily be helped. But you need to be lucky. You need to have a great GP. You need to have resources that you can maybe pay in situations where it's not available free of charge. And, like, a lot of people don't have those things. So this is going to be amazing. We're going to start to rectify those problems for those poor, poor ladies.
Okay. And I was trying to work out, I reckon there could be up to 600,000 women in that age group who are going through the menopause in Ireland at the minute.
Easily.
Why the silence? Is it embarrassing?
I don't know. Like, it's hard for me to empathize because I have no filter. Yeah. You know, vagina is a family word in our house. Yeah, do you know what I mean? So for me, it means very little. But I heard Davina McCall say that when she got menopause so bad, she needed to do something about it and eventually took HRT. She didn't tell anybody.
Yeah, including her best friend.
What the heck? What's that about? You should be screaming. Like, I love showing my patches to the patients to say, listen, I'm doing it.
These are HRT patches.
Yeah. I don't pull my trouser down. But, you know, I let the top of my trouser down and say, look at my patch, you know.
And Davina McCall said she said she lied to her friends.
Yeah, that's scary.
Because what she didn't, what's the end, feel is the end of your femininity, end of your...
I think we're our own worst enemy, aren't we? Sometimes women maybe more so than men, in that we expect so much from ourselves, perfection. And when we fall short, we feel like we're weak or less than. And maybe if you can't manage your menopausal symptoms with yoga and, holistic therapy or something, you're a failure, which is so not fair. It's not true and it's not fair.
Okay. And what's your title, Deirdre?
Because
is menopause in your title?
No, I'm just a doctor.
Is menopause in any medic's title in Ireland?
No, not that I'm aware of. We don't have a faculty of sexual and reproductive health. We either have a gynecology surgeon or a GP. There's no in between. Like, in the United Kingdom, they have the Faculty of Sexual and Reproductive Health, whose job it is to manage menopause.
And that's your umbrella, isn't it?
I use their guidelines because we don't have any Irish equivalent. So were I in the UK, I'd be a consultant in sexual and reproductive health, but we don't have that. So I'm just a doctor.
Okay, address just briefly, because it's going to come, and it came up right from the get-go last week. This study, I think it's 2002, that I was looking at the headlines this morning. Every newspaper, HRT causes cancer.
That was
the study. And that study has been completely debunked, even in terms of its methodology.
Oh, completely,
And in terms of the age group that they said they were using. And they weren't using it, and it was finished early.
Abandoned. That study has a lot to answer for. That study actually condemned a generation or two of women to unnecessary suffering. It was convened by the National Institute of Health, which is a big American governmental body, and it was looking to see, would certain therapies increase longevity and prevent disease in aging women? So they recruited 16,000 ladies in the United States, all between 50 and 80.
Okay.
And they gave them quite copious amounts of that horse's urine.
Premarin.
With a very strong progestogen tablet on top of it. It was called Prempro. And, you know, we don't do that as a rule. We all try to avoid equine estrogen wherever possible. We rarely use oral unless a person is in tip-top health. The women in that study, the average age was 63, which is actually pretty much beyond the worst phase of the menopause.
Okay.
And their main focus, their endpoint was, if we give all women hormones, will we prevent fractures and heart attacks and premature death and aging? And actually, the answer was, yeah, we probably would. But the problem was that strong estrogen in that older cohort of women had an impact on breast cancer diagnosis. Now, the impact was very, very small.
Mm-hmm.
It showed that if you were between 50 and 60, used HRT for more than 5 years, your risk of breast cancer went from 23 in 1,000, which is background, to 27 in 1,000, which is a 26% increase. But it sounds much worse.
Statistically,
they don't say like 970 you will never get breast cancer, you know, out of 1,000. But anyway, if you drink a big glass of wine a night, your risk is already 28 in 1,000. And if you're chubby like me, your risk is 47 in 1,000. And they didn't put it into context, you know.
So has it been completely debunked?
I think so. I'd like to think so.
Well, again, looking at the story in the UK, they reckon when that story broke in 2002, and it was here as well, it was on the front page of all the newspapers.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
They reckon 1 million women in Britain threw their HRT tablets out.
Overnight. Stopped overnight.
Crazy. Yeah.
And Mary called with her story.
When I wrote into you last night, what I was talking about is the fact that when I was in my mid-30s, I went to get acupuncture for something, nothing of any significance really, not that I can remember. But the practitioner asked me about the menopause.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember at the time thinking, I was horrified. And I was horrified for two reasons, because, like, first of all, I thought, oh, my God, I'm only 30. Do you realize? Now I know, having listened to your program over the last few days, that there are women out there in their late 20s, early 30s. But at the time, I didn't know that. At the time, I just thought, like, you know, 50-year-old plus women, 60-year-old women, old women get the menopause. So I was kind of insulted to be asked about the menopause. And apart from being insulted, I also hated hearing the actual word menopause, because for me the word kind of conjures up images of like old age and the scrap heap, you know what I mean? So anyway, I was 30 at the time. I'm 53 now, so
you're still young, very
you know,
young.
My take on life is a bit different, but at the time I remember the word menopause scared me, and it still scares me now, I'm going to be honest. But anyway, so there I was, 30, and if you fast forward to 15 years later, so I was roughly 51, I think, and it was 2019, and I was still getting my periods. So at 51, I hadn't had the menopause.
Yeah.
I realise now I was perimenopausal, and I think I learned the word perimenopausal around 40, at the age of 49. I didn't even know the word existed prior to that. But at 51, anyway, had my periods, and I always suffered occasionally from heavy periods, you know, now and again.
Yeah.
So, but at the age of 51, the summer of 2019, I started getting like really, really, really heavy periods. So I put this down to the menopause.
Okay.
And I thought, oh, do you know what? Now I'm going through the menopause, heavy periods, blah, blah, blah. And then one day I suffered from a really heavy period. And then one night, about 2 o'clock in the morning, I just hemorrhaged blood, absolutely hemorrhaged blood. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, I'm going to have to go to the A&E. But, like, how do I get there? And you know what I mean? It was like I was bleeding, so I didn't know how to get myself there. Anyway, luckily it stopped. And I went to the doctor. And between the jigs and the reels, anyway, I discovered I had cancer in the wall of the womb. Whereas I was putting it down to being menopausal. And my ignorance, I suppose, of the menopause didn't help, you know. So I had to have an uberectomy. Now, in the letter to you, I said hysterectomy because it was easier to spell. But anyway, I ended up having my womb and my ovaries removed. And obviously then with that, I was going to be going into the menopause. But following that, then I had chemotherapy and radiotherapy. So that kind of confused the issue because then I didn't know what was chemo and what was the menopause. I finished all of that last May. I'm a year out of it now, and I'm happy to say I feel great. I'm a year over chemo. Mary, I suppose I wanted people to know that sometimes, because we don't know, and I'm very happy to stick my head in the sand, because I'm scared of what the word menopause means. I'm scared of the symptoms. I don't, you know, the way there's like a beginning, a middle, and an end, kind of a bad menopause, a worse menopause, and an even worse menopause. Everybody wants to have the best possible menopause, the lightest possible symptoms.
So what I hear you saying, and your description earlier was brilliant, when you were told in your 30s about the menopause, how do you educate, and this is your, these are your, how do you educate people about the menopause, Deirdre, without scaring them? This,
I think it's an attitudinal thing, isn't it? Like, I love this time in my life. I'm 60 this year. I'm in better form, I think, than I've been before, you know. Mm-hmm. But you know, I have to remember other people's menopause. Like, I think of my mother and my grandmother, and it was a different time, you know. I'm thinking house coats and slippers and naps, you know, which we don't have the luxury of.
And we had a phenomenon in Ireland called the nervous breakdown.
Exactly, a little midlife.
I never knew what it was, but
that's what it was.
Women in there in Ballyfermot used to get, she had a nervous breakdown.
Apparently, I read in an article years ago that back in the United States in the 60s, there was a medicine called Mother's Little Helper for the menopause. And it was a combination of Valium and estrogen.
No, thanks.
Well, that's Mary, and on it went. If menopause is something you want to know more about, I'd really urge you to go and listen to Dr. Lundy on the whole Liveline programme, on the show webpage or on the radio player. And on Morning Ireland, the change in the law for adopted people. Bláthnaid Hurley, who was adopted from Bessborough, explained how important this was for her.
New legislation published yesterday would allow for adopted people to get access to their birth certs even if a parent indicates they don't wish to be identified. It's a change in the law that's been sought by adopted people in Ireland for decades. Bláthnaid Hurley was adopted from Bessborough Mother and Baby Home in County Cork. Last night she spoke to our reporter Joan O'Sullivan about what the possibility of finally getting access to her real birth certificate means to her.
I'm actually overwhelmed. I am in tears, and I'm not normally a very emotional person, but I'm experiencing something that I never thought I would live to see. I never thought that I would get the right to have a birth certificate the same as most people that I know who live in this country have. I thought I would forever have a piece of paper that really doesn't tell the truth about me. It says I was born in Dublin and I wasn't. I was born in Cork, and there's lots of other inconsistencies in there. But the fact that I now have the same rights as everybody else is just, it's completely overwhelming.
Why is it so important to get a real birth certificate?
It's almost like a recognition that you're a real person, that you're a real citizen of this country, that you too can now stand up and hold your head high and have the same rights and prove who you are to everybody else. Because up until now, you only have the documentation that you've been allowed to have, and you don't know whether the information that's on those documents is true. I really thought at this stage in my life that I would never get to hold a birth certificate. And now I know there are a few more hoops and whatever for it to go through for the legislation to be passed. But for the first time ever in my life, there seems to be real hope that this is what's actually going to happen.
The legislation is also going to provide a pathway by which people may be able to get in contact with their relatives. What do you think about that?
I like the idea that the pathway is there for those who wish to go that way. But I also like the fact that there is a caveat in there that if somebody doesn't want to be traced
for whatever reason, and it's their personal reason, I think they should have the right to be able to say that they want to hold on to their privacy and they don't want somebody unannounced turning up at their door. For me personally, that was never my main goal. If my mother is still alive and if she or any of my family are still there and wish to make contact or wish to be contacted by me, I would be more than happy to do that. But I would never impose myself into somebody else's life.
Bláthaine Hurley speaking with Joan O'Sullivan for Morning Ireland. And on the Ryan Tuberty Show, Ryan really, really wanted to understand the lure of pennies.
Three kids dropped to school, says Irene in County Meath, and I'm on my way to Pennies for my 10 o'clock appointment. Happiness is. Can anyone in three words explain to me? Explain to me, please, in three words. I do not want essays. I do not want theses. I don't want the pain of a PhD. I simply want a very short, three-word, pithy text to explain what the obsession with pennies is. Three words, and I'll leave yous alone. And as soon as I see it, three words that to me explain why people are getting stretch limos, are dumping their kids at school. School's probably not even on. Just leave them in an empty yard with a pterodactyl seagull above in the sky, emptying the contents of a Big Mac meal on them. You don't care because you want to get your 10 o'clock appointment at €5 pennies. What is it?
Oh, yes, of course. The floodgates opened.
Now, three words. Pennies. Living within means. Mm-hmm. Cheap and cheerful. Okay. Cheap as chips. All right. Cheap lasting underwear. Okay. Pennies a fiver. Okay. It's absolutely essential. I'll let you away with that. Cheap thrills. Missing a word. Huns love bits. Okay. I'll go through them all and then I'm going to stop. That's fine. Thanks, hon. Pennies. I understand that. You probably think I wouldn't get value, variety, fun. Mm-hmm. Pennies from heaven. All right. Bang for buck. Okay. And then it's funny because everyone's having the crack, and then some of the heads come in going, no, 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 no pennies. No. Don't make stuff like that. No. Pennies. More exciting clutter. Okay. Fast factory. Oh, yeah. Fast fashion addiction. And now we get into the debatey side of things. All right. Pajama clad girls, don't be snobby. There's nothing wrong with... Listen. Now. Ryan, give me credit for getting it in two words. You're back. I thought you were gone. I said three words. They were the rules of this competition. You gave me two, so no credit. Affordable new... But I admire you coming back, though. Affordable new stuff. All right. It was closed. Good. Very good. Why are you so obsessed? Because it was closed. It's no sin. You see, the it's is you're getting away with murder now, getting four words in there with that. Tan, lashes, nails. That's where I go. Cheap manufactured junk, says Ray. Come back. Christmas came early, if you don't mind. PJs, socks, knickers. Okay, that's it. We're done. Don't want one more. Save yourself. How much is it to send a text in? Save yourself whatever it is. No more. That's it. We had a bit of crack with that and now we have more to do.
He gets it. That's Ryan in the morning. Well, we all know about NIMBYs, but what about YIMBYs? The Yes in My Back Garden. Carol Dieter, financial and mortgage analyst, and Lorcan Sir, senior lecturer in housing studies at Technical University Dublin, we're going head to head on Today with Claire Byrne.
We've all heard of NIMBYism, haven't we? The acronym for Not in My Backyard, a complaint from those who object to proposed new developments. But a new movement, YIMBYs, say yes in my backyard to any kind of new housing development, even high density or high rise, if it helps to boost the supply of homes. Well, one such YIMBY, Carl Dieter, joins me on the line now. And here in the studio is Lorcan Sir, a senior lecturer in housing studies at Technical University Dublin, who says, don't blame the objectors, it's the speculators' fault. So, Carl, I'm going to start with you. Good morning to you first. You're in a really unusual position yourself. You believe that everyone should be prepared to allow housing to be built near them, no matter how much that damages the price of their house.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you look at the situation we have with homelessness, with, you know, not having enough housing for people, all those problems, you're not going to solve it by stopping that activity from occurring. And I just think that it's a far more, socially cohesive approach to say, you know, I don't want to keep people out of my area.
Mm-hmm.
That I actually do, you know, love and cherish everybody. And in that sense, if you want to live near me, I welcome you. And I think that that's the right way to do it. I think it's actually, it's really wrong that every time there's a sizable development, that just all these different groups start to line up and stop it. And I suppose in housing, you fall into two camps. You've got those who can create housing and those who can't. You know, I don't make housing. I'm not a carpenter. I can't functionally do it. And I feel there's a moral imperative to not stand in the way of the people who can build housing. So my message is clear in general. If you believe in people and believe in our ability to get through a housing crisis, then you've got to say yes. If you don't, and you start these objections, you're actually creating the problem that you say gives you cause for concern. I think that's just deeply cynical, deeply hypocritical. So I'm saying yes. And I don't
and you,
say
you
that
are,
like
and you really are saying yes, because I don't want to make this too personalised, but you're in this situation yourself, aren't you?
I am. In fact, there's a strategic housing development happening that is totally going to affect me. I mean, my house is mentioned in the plan because that's how affected it is.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be over 400 homes going in around me possibly, and places that were fields where I'd hunt or train dogs, they'll all be houses. But I've just gone straight to the acceptance phase. And it's really liberating. You know, I'm not going to fight progress. It seems illogical. You know, and it must be exhausting to sit around saying no, for a million reasons, no.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need to stop thinking about housing as if it's a standalone thing. I mean, imagine if houses were jobs and someone announced 1,000 jobs. People wouldn't jump up and down and protest screaming, this is terrible. If those people get a job, there'll be less money in the economy for me. We know that's not the case. Everyone's better off when we all have jobs. And in the same way, everybody, when it comes to housing, is better off when there is abundant, accessible and ideally affordable housing.
Lorcan, can I bring you in on this? You believe that people with reasonable objections to a planning application are entitled to air their views. But given the crisis that we're in, the more we object to development, isn't it clear and true that the more house prices will rise?
Look, the first thing to say here is that, you know, Carl and myself and yourself, we're looking to live in an environment where we have the opportunity to participate in a planning process, and we should cherish that. We should be very wary of reducing the ability for public participation for lots of reasons, partly because it improves transparency and reduces corruption and increases trust in politics.
Mm. Just but because you can doesn't mean you should, though.
No, but there's a couple of issues here and like really big assumptions. And the first one is that objections or observations, as they're properly called, stop development. Don't objections just go in and there's something that they're had regard to, and if they're serious enough, a development will stop, but only on direction of the courts. And if the court decide that something is seriously wrong with the application and it's seriously detrimental, then they will stop the development. So putting in an observation that turns out to be an objection is not going to necessarily stop, only the courts will stop any development. And the second assumption here is that all development is good, and of course all development is not good. Some of it is terrible, and some of the plans that get submitted are awful. And we saw a good case a couple of years ago where a very senior politician objected to the conversion of a pub in his constituency to 41 apartments, and he objected to that, and what turned out there was more than 200 co-living units, actually with 14 co-living units in the basement, which Umbro Plana in fairness took out. So, you know, he is on record as saying that I'm in favour of development, just not every development.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to be careful that not all development is good. We've built thousands of houses and housing units, shall we say, over the last few years. Lots of student accommodation, lots of co-living, lots of built to rent. They are not much good for families trying to access affordable accommodation.
People getting in touch with us on this one. Carl, for you, this person says, stop labelling objectors as the bogeymen. No other European capitals allow high-rise monster towers beside the old quarter of their city. So sometimes you have to object because what's being proposed is just wrong.
Okay, well, look, if they prefer to have no houses, then justify that however you want. Like, you've got to sleep at night. And people have to live with their own cognitive dissonance where they say, oh, I'm against homelessness, I'm against high house prices, and yet I'm also against more houses. Deal with that whatever way you want. I'm at the acceptance phase. I know that the answer is to start saying yes.
And Lorcan wanted to make a point about lobbying in planning.
Lorcan?
One of the processes we have that was brought in by lobbyists a couple of years ago who pretty much wrote the legislation is the strategic housing development process, which is what's going up beside Carl there. And that effectively removes opportunities for public participation. And I know, because I went and looked up the numbers, that, you know, there's currently in the four Dublin local authorities, which is where the main housing affordability crisis is, there's 26,500 planning permissions under the SHD process alone. Only 1% of those have been ever built. So it's very, you know, and that's before COVID, because we don't want to bring in COVID to mess it up. So only 1.4% of those have been built. So it's evidently not planning objections or people putting in observations that's holding up development. Mm-hmm. It's land speculation. It's people getting planning permission for land and then selling on to someone else who gets even more and selling it on.
You have no problem then with serial objectors as they're described?
Well, I'd like to know what a definition of a serial objector is. How many objections or observations do you have to put in to be categorised as a serial objector? And one of the interesting things is I think a lot of politicians would fall into that category, because when you look up particularly kind of controversial developments, you'll find it's politicians who are in there, and very, very senior politicians. I'm not going to mention them, but, you know, people way at the top of government are, you know, they could well fall into the category of serial objector. And it's one of the roles that kind of local politicians, in particular TDs and councillors, fulfil on behalf of their constituents. It's public participation. It's a democracy. Mm-hmm. That's what we live in.
Do you think that should be stopped?
Absolutely not.
The third-party property rights, by the way, which is the Irish way of dealing with planning, you know, most countries don't actually have that. And that's a really important thing. The fact that you can, like, weigh in on other people's property and have some rights on that, it doesn't exist in other countries. My little brother is a builder in Arkansas. He can get permission to build a house in 3 weeks. And guess what? Because they have effective planning and building, they don't have a housing crisis. I mean, like, a tornado can come and rip your house off the ground and then that's a crisis, but that's not, like, a statewide thing.
I'm not sure we should be holding up America as a virtue of anything to do with town planning or sustainable development, to be honest with you, Carol, as you know.
Lorcan, don't start that, you know, Europe look down your nose at America crap. New York, Chicago, all over America, they've got wonderful stuff there. That's really, really dismissive of a wonderful country. Don't be like that.
No, I'm saying it is well known that, like, you know, if for unsustainable development, they might get planning permission in 3 weeks in somewhere like Arkansas. But, you know, America is not exactly a bastion of good town planning. Like, best practice in planning, as we know.
Be specific. Where's bad?
Best practice in planning, as we know, is about early engagement, and it's more frequent engagement, and that has proven throughout Europe to provide better outcomes for developers and for communities, and so it's called co-creation. Right, what we're intent on here and what we've been doing for the last 5 years since Alan Kelly is restricting public participation, and that has ended up in the courts, and we find that on Bourke-Pinola, for example, are losing 80% of all judicial reviews that are taken against them because of bad legislation.
Do you believe, Lorcan, that if we drastically increase supply, we are going to make houses more affordable?
Well, the last time we drastically increased supply, the only thing that brought down house prices was a market crash. So, you know, you got to realise that housing is like a luxury good, and you don't find luxury goods makers oversupplying a market, because nobody builds when prices are falling. So it's called the absorption rate. So typically house builders will supply housing at a rate to maintain the price that they want to make a profit at. And what we see recently with government with Help to Buy and shared equity is what we're doing is helping people afford what's on offer rather than making what's on offer more affordable. Yeah. So we're maintaining those high prices.
It's a decent point, Carl, and we don't have to look back too far. When we had a glut of housing in the boom, there were houses that people couldn't afford then either.
True. But I mean, if you make a mistake in the past, it doesn't mean that you won't make a mistake now or that what we're doing isn't a mistake. So, I mean, you can say yes to all that stuff and still say yes to housing.
Yeah, but the bottom line of your argument is, isn't it, like, don't say no to stuff in your area because we need the supply. But putting the supply in place doesn't necessarily mean that people will be able to afford to buy the homes.
OK, let me reverse that question to you, Claire. So let's just say that we say no to everything and nothing happens. Will we be any better off, yes or no?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a good point. I mean, I don't know what the answer is, Lorcan.
I think you do. I think you know we won't.
Yeah, you know, the supply argument is kind of, it's very, I don't want to use the word simplistic, but it's very black and white. It's very linear. You need the right supply at the right price and the right type of supply. So just throwing up anything, like we could build 25,000 student houses next year and the number of houses built would be, 25,000.
I don't know if they get counted.
No, okay, but built to rent.
You're talking like the Goldilocks parable of when we were kids.
But the point is,
get it just right. It's never just right. And that's why you have to go at it one way or the other.
Well, Carol is right there. It is never just right. And one of the kind of misnomers that's put out there is that we have a dysfunctional housing market. Actually, that makes the assumption that there is such a thing as a functional housing market, and we've never had a functional housing market.
Lorcan Sir and Carol Dieter on Today with Claire Byrne. And it was the morning after the findings of the Ballymurphy inquest. Here's Gavin Jennings.
Entirely innocent of all wrongdoing, families and friends of 10 people shot dead in West Belfast 50 years ago were welcomed home to Ballymurphy last night to cheers, tears and relief after the longest ever inquest in Northern Ireland found that the deaths of 10 people killed in 3 days in August 1971 after the introduction of internment without trial were unjustified. That 9 people were shot dead by British soldiers, Joan Connolly, Father Hugh Mullen, Frank Quinn, Noel Phillips, Daniel Teggart, Joseph Murphy, John Laverty, Joseph Corr and Edward Doherty. Justice Siobhan Keegan couldn't make a finding on who shot John James McCurr because of what she described as an abject failure to investigate at the time. An 11th victim, Pat McCarthy, died of a heart attack. The British Army had falsely claimed all were armed members of the IRA. Padraig O'Murray is solicitor for the Ballymurphy families. Padraig, good morning. Thanks for taking our call today.
Good morning.
What are your reflections this morning about yesterday's events? It must have been a deeply emotional day.
It was deeply emotional. A momentous day for these families and the wider Ballymurphy community. The families have known for 50 years that their loved ones were innocent, but that's not enough. They need official acknowledgement and legal vindication of their innocence, and they have that today.
What are you expecting to happen next?
The families will obviously digest. These findings were provided in summary form by the coroner yesterday. We will now need to go through the very detailed findings, which run into hundreds and hundreds of pages. In parallel with the inquest process, we initiated civil proceedings against the Ministry of Defence. And given the very critical findings in this report, we can move that forward with some vigour now.
Is there sufficient evidence to mount a prosecution?
Well, the coroner did refer to the lack of investigation in these cases. 50 years on from events, it's very difficult to bring a case to the criminal court, which is a higher standard of proof that is beyond reasonable doubt. However, there are some examples of soldiers being identified within this inquest, and that's a matter that the families will need to consider over the coming days, whether they then engage with the Director of Public Prosecutions. The coroner didn't comment in her summary findings yesterday on that issue, and we will need to digest the more detailed report to see if there's any indication from the coroner she intends to send a file to the Director of Public Prosecutions, but certainly that's something we'll be considering.
Some of the relatives don't want prosecutions. One woman said yesterday the man who shot her dad is now 80 and she doesn't want to see him in court. Does that matter?
It does. I mean, what you'll find, and I'm working with a number of families, hundreds of families from the conflict, and even within one family you will get differences of opinion. And sometimes their thinking on it evolves. When they have truth, then sometimes they want more. They want to move on to the justice process once they find that truth. So it's different. Even within campaigns, even within individual families, there may well be differences of opinion. However, I don't think it's a matter for the British Prime Minister or under pressure from right-wing media or the ex-Fets community to decide on prosecutions. That should be done by an independent prosecuting authority.
Padraig O'Murray, solicitor for the Ballymurphy families. Then later, Geraldine McGrattan spoke to Gavin about her uncle, Father Hugh Mullen.
The coroner said that she was quite convinced Father Hugh Mullen was a peacemaker and that he was carrying a white object at the time that he was shot after he went to help a wounded man who called for help. His niece, Geraldine McGrattan, is with us now. Geraldine, good morning and thank you very much for taking our call today after what I can only imagine was a very long and emotional day yesterday. How are you this morning?
I am very tired, but I'm still in awe of what happened yesterday and all the wonderful things Justice Keegan said about my uncle.
Do yesterday's findings help you and your family to come to terms with what happened 50 years ago?
I think they give us peace. For 50 years, I suppose we have carried the anger and the hurt that he was killed. We didn't know exactly what had happened to him. We didn't know why he had been killed or how he had been killed. And now everything has been explained to us. We know now that the British Army fired with a disproportionate force into the area where he was. So it brings a kind of peace that everyone now knows that he was totally innocent of. He wasn't a gunman. He was a good man going out to help another wounded person and waving a white flag.
And how do you reflect on what Justice Keegan said about your uncle?
It was so good to hear her say that he was a peacemaker. We knew from the inquest that he had walked the streets during the evenings, trying to calm situations, putting himself at risk, but he had done it. He had talked to army, he had talked to young people. He had really tried very hard to keep things calm. During that day of the 9th of August, he had rang the army a couple of times to say how bad things were around the area where he lived. He had worked so hard to do it, and to hear her say that was truly wonderful for us. Then to hear her describe his wounds and how he had died, that was difficult to hear. But to hear the innocent, entirely innocent, and the disproportionate force by the army, it was hard to hear. It was hard to hear that they had just let loose. But it was good to get the truth out into the public domain.
Your uncle was very young at the time. You were very young at the time. How do you remember your Uncle Hugh?
Well, I was 18 when he died. He was 38. My mother was 39. We were a very close-knit family. We come from a small village on the shores of Strangford Loch. So, you know, my granny and my granddad, my uncles, we were all, everyone was in and out of each other's houses. My uncle was home most weeks from his parish for dinner. I'm the eldest grandchild, so I was always in my granny's. We would have had, you know, family dinners. My mother sang. My uncle played the guitar. He loved to sail. He loved to swim. He loved to try to teach us how to do both. He really enjoyed young people. He enjoyed being in our company. He loved his sister and brothers. He was a family man. He loved people. People liked him.
Geraldine, what do you want to happen now? Do you want the man who shot him to be prosecuted?
Well, the army did not give much information, as you would have read from the findings yesterday. We only know that it was soldiers from Two Para or Three Queens who fired the shots, but we don't really have any one particular soldier. So I think really it's now up to our legal team to decide what the next step would be. At the moment, I am happy, I am at peace that we have got the truth out, that his name is cleared and he has been named as a peacemaker rather than a gunman.
Geraldine McGrattan, remembering her uncle, Father Hugh Mullen, for Morning Ireland with Gavin Jennings. And on Today with Claire Byrne, Superintendent Ted Hastings and the way he might look at you. Why are we so obsessed with slang and the turn of phrase?
I'm interested in one thing and one thing only, and that's bent covers.
And we will be left holding a sprat when we should have landed a mackerel.
All you wish.
He will not leave a stone unturned. I have been shifting heaven and earth.
Plus, you were going like the clappers.
We weren't born yesterday, fella.
And I don't care whether it's one rotten apple or the whole bloody barrel.
Well, back to the coal-faced Aperia, unless you've got some more egg-sucking tips for your granny.
I didn't float up the wagon on a bubble.
Oh, Jesus, Mary and Joseph.
Mother.
Well, now we're sucking diesel. So Claire wanted to get to the bottom of slang in the company of, amongst others, Colm O'Regan.
What is slang, Colm?
Well, do you have any other questions, actually?
No.
It's a big question, and it's an interesting one because what is one person's slang was originally somebody else's language. So I think it's easy language. It's stuff that allows people to communicate in a way that almost they recognise where they're from,
That's
even as
it.
Soon as they open their mouth.
I think it's a code. It says, I know where you're from. We know each other. We have a bond here from the get-go.
Exactly, yeah. And it's funny, like for me, if I'm from Cork, but I've been living... Yeah. But I moved away because I couldn't get work. I moved to Dublin. But when I meet people from Cork... straight away, the slang level goes up because I think I know I'm among my own people. Yeah. So there's definitely a bit of code going on.
Okay, Martin, let's talk about greetings, right? When you meet someone, first of all, because that's a good way really of demonstrating the differences between the slang that people have. How would you greet another person if you met them on a street?
Usually from two meters away. Start off with that. Let's get the message out there. I think in Ireland it's all the same, really, isn't it? It's kind of like, what's the crack? What's the story? Any crack with you? Those type of things. I suppose I'm lucky. You see, I come from the travelling community, but I'm also from a little town called Toom in the west of Ireland, mm-hmm. in Galway. Which is in East Galway, and we would have slang there as well, which is kind of like it's like pig Latin, basically. So we would say something like, Wegas de Steg or Ishe Gami Wegaid. So something like that.
What?
To kind of, exactly. exactly, Claire.
I'm excluded. I have no idea what you're saying.
You can bet your life you're excluded, Claire. You know? which is basically, well, what's the crack with you?
Okay.
So it's kind of like, I suppose, as Colm said there, it is kind of like the words do come from something. It's a type of Creole, maybe.
I don't know something that confuses me a little bit. And I'm from Laois, as people may know, but I find in the West when people meet you, they go, "Well," and I see that as a question. I don't really know what the answer is. Like, what is the answer to "well" with a question mark at the end?
You just say "well," man.
Okay. Write that down. Write that down for the next time.
It also depends on who you're talking to. Like, if you're approaching a gang of people leaning against a wall, you might say "hoard them in, hoard the lads." You know, "how's it going?" Or indeed, not a bad day for it, whatever it might be.
What
you
is
know?
It? Yeah,
yeah,
that's
exactly.
Another question that we don't need to answer. And Nuala, how are you? Thanks very much for joining us in Belfast.
I'm sticking out and dead on, we would probably say up here.
As hello.
Well, no, that would be the answer. The question would be about you,
okay.
Which means what about you? But in the country up here, would say, "How's she cutting?" But I was listening to the lads there, and I love the one in Derry. Weirdly, they greet you a bit like you said with "well." They say, "Yes," as in, "Yes, Nuala," as if you've been asked the question in advance. But even weirder, there's people, I don't know if it's Derry, Donegal or where, but they address you like this. So say it to me, they'll come up and say, "Well, how's Nuala?"
Right.
Which I'm always thinking, well, she's okay. She's wondering why she's being addressed in the third person when she's standing right in front of you.
And
but apart from that, she's dead on.
And is Nuala expected to answer that when you get you're asked?
Yeah,
well, okay.
You kind of go, well, she's just here. She's looking, she's, as they would say, sticking out her dead on. Yeah.
Do you get that, Colm? Yeah, yes, Colm, as hello.
Not yet, but I'm looking forward to it. The problem for me now is that no matter how I'm addressed, is that the pandemic has brought a halt to actually how to reply. It's like small talk has disappeared. So all you can reply now is, "Oh, sure, look, this is it," as in a general discussion of the whole situation. So I think we need to get back to small talk classes in order to reply to, no matter how you're asked, whether it's "well," "yes," "how's she cutting," or any of those. It's what you say next without saying, "Well, to be honest, things are tough." Because you can't say that in Ireland. Like, you can't be going in with the big conversation.
Yeah,
so.
No, but nobody wants an answer. Really,
no,
to that,
we don't really care how you are. We're just trying to start talking.
You really have to worry when somebody addresses you and the first word isn't "yes," it's "no." No, Colm. I think as kids, we all grew up with it. No, no.
And what about "mas," "mams," and "mammies"?
Well, I called my mother "mama," a thing I only admitted in open as an adult. But, I mean, there's also, like, there's a bit of kind of reverse snobbery where people say if you call your mother "mom," that it's somehow an Americanization, when in fact, the further, often if you go into West Kerry or in parts of Cork, people say "mom" as well. But that comes from the Irish way of saying "ma'am." So
"mommy."
Yeah, "mommy" or whatever. So it's interesting how it's not that simple. And then, of course, in Dublin, there's lots of "ma's" and "mams." And then there's some people who you hear them say "ma'am" and you go, "I don't think you were a ma'am person. I think you're a mum person." Mm-hmm. I think you're only looking for a bit of authenticity there. So it's
mom
a very
is English, isn't it? Mom is English.
It's a bit more English, yeah. But the interesting thing is there's less dad ones. There's da and dad and daddy, but there's no duds. Well, you know, depending on what he was like. But there are you know, there's less choice.
And Martin, what about you on the mother front? Ma'am,
so, okay,
mammy?
No, it's mommy.
Mommy.
And in the phone it's saved as "mom," just in case she ever rings while I'm in company.
Okay.
Because I never say "mommy." And if she's in a bad mood, we just call her "ma'am crass," which is not too far away from where I'm living.
And just, I mean, you mentioned your background, your travelling community background, Martin, and you have slang, as I said earlier, that we don't understand, would you say?
Well, there's a lot of things you don't understand, to be fair, no. but let's focus on the language, I suppose. Yeah, we're like, well, look, we'd have shelter or cant or the gammon. And what's really good about that is the language is kind of crossed over. And again, going back to what Colm said, because Colm's great for jumping in there and kind of stealing my words at the beginning. Typical Corkonian, you know, because they've robbed our language.
That's right, so yeah. Talk it down.
What are the cant words that you say have crossed over?
Oh, I can't remember. No, so you would be talking about the likes of Tome, Gammy, Bjor, Fien, Lush.
Is Gammy a cant word?
Well, I've been brought up to think it was anyway. Mm-hmm. I don't... actually, that's a good question because I think the word Gammy may have been stolen by the travellers. Oh, there we go.
Well, I used Gammy growing up. I often remember we were doing the play by the Western World and there's a quote in it saying, "Oh, for a young man with such and such and a gamey heart." And one of the lads was reading out saying, "Oh, for a young man with a gammy heart." So we definitely use it. And we used... it's. I only found out years later that I was using Fien and Bjor and Sham, that they actually were traveller words. So I'm giving them back now. I'm sorry for taking them, Martin.
From Today with Claire Byrne. And in the morning, as luck would have it, ye oldie matchmakers are bringing the lovelorn here to find their heart's desire. Here's Gavin.
Now, an American woman travels to Ireland to buy land to build a resort, enters the local matchmaking festival to prove her investment, and meets local councillor and whiskey distiller Brennan O'Brien. You can probably guess where this is going. Yes, it's a film, it's American, and it's called As Luck Would Have It.
I knew you screwed up my soda, Brad. I was so careful.
I know. I'm sorry.
And you should have given me those points in hurling.
Still on the fence about that one.
Wait, what about Siobhan's class? Did you mess up my yarn?
No, that was all you.
So Stephanie Rogerson from Seattle watched the film and she's getting on the road to Listoon Varna.
The Hallmark movie was about an American lady who had gone to Ireland on a business trip. And while she was there, the matchmaking festival was taking place and they really showcased just this wonderful experience, everything from sporting events to learning how to make Irish soda bread or to knit, just to take in the different culture. And there was, you know, music and dancing and various speed dating. It just seemed so fun and so wholesome and just a nice breath of fresh air than what, you know, people are used to dating nowadays, swipe right, swipe left, all that good stuff. During the commercial, I grabbed my cell phone and I looked up international matchmaking festivals and was quite surprised to learn that this Hallmark movie was actually based off of the Listoon Varna matchmaking festival. And so I immediately set out to see how I could get myself over there and who was putting it on, and found their Facebook page and made a contact with Julie Carr. And I'm just trying to learn as much about it as I can and hoping that they get to have the festival this year so I can attend in person.
Who would travel with you, or what plans do you have?
I had a 2-week European vacation planned last year that didn't get to happen because of COVID. So I've just kind of reselected the locations I'd be visiting. And I think I would spend at least a week in Ireland and then maybe go spend a couple more days in London and then take the channel over to Paris and get to see the Eiffel Tower.
And with the times we live in, with social media and all the dating apps and websites, why a matchmaking festival in Ireland?
Because it's something I haven't done before. And the gentleman who's been putting on the matchmaking festival and how it's been in his family for many years. And then I like that it's kind of a remote location. It's not necessarily centralized in a busy city. It just seemed different and just more wholesome to me.
So what would you hope for?
It would be nice to meet a variety of people and always hoping to meet your love connection. I like trying new experiences, and in my hometown, I was voted the most friendliest person. So I'm always, you know, eager to make a new acquaintance and things along those lines. That's kind of where I'm at with that.
And Stephanie, what about your friends when you explained to them about this matchmaking festival in Ireland? What was their reaction?
Well, my friend Michelle's married, but she said she's always up for going on an adventure with me. She'll hold my purse while I do some speed dating. And then I have a couple other friends that I've reached out to, and they've told me to keep them posted and they'll see how things shake out.
Ah, she sounds lovely, doesn't she? Stephanie from Seattle. Then Gavin Jennings spoke to Julie Carr from the Listoon Varna Matchmaking Festival.
And we've had a massive amount of interest since the film was released. We have about 25,000 people on our Facebook page, and there's been a few thousand extra people have, you know, requested to join. And we also have a private Facebook group. We've had loads of messages. Stephanie was one of the people that contacted me originally. She was very, very excited. And it's all really from America and from Canada that people are interested in coming. They actually couldn't believe that there was a real matchmaking festival. You know, as I say, like Stephanie Googled it. They thought it was something made up. So they were delighted to find out it actually existed. So it's fantastic publicity for us, you know, for the festival and for the area. And hopefully when travel opens up, we'll get lots of people travelling from America and from Canada.
Julie. I mean, the festival was cancelled last year because of COVID. Is it going to go ahead this year? And when will you know?
Well, we haven't decided yet whether it's going to go ahead. We're waiting on government guidelines, re-indoor gatherings, and we can't make that decision yet until it's clarified. It'll probably be in July when we make an announcement. I mean, Longitude was recently cancelled, so we're keeping a very you know, keen eye on developments. As you know, health and safety is our main priority. And we know that there was a large-scale event in Liverpool. There was a pilot event run in Sefton Park. So we were very interested to see what happened with that. And we've actually put a proposal in to the Tourism Minister, Catherine Martin, and Stephen Donnelly, you know, that we suggested that we could do something similar. So we're just waiting to hear back about that.
Julie Carr from Morning Ireland with Gavin Jennings. And on the Ryan Tuberty Show, the 12th of May was marked by Ken Healy because it's a very important day.
Yeah, it's International Nurses Day, Ryan.
I didn't know that the nurses had an international day like today.
Well,
so
it's apparently it's the birthday for Florence Nightingale. Nightingale's birthday.
Okay, well, let me say happy International Nurses Day to all the nursing staff listening in around the world, and particularly on this island today, because as you well know, Ken, now more than ever, the nurses need to be given the love and gratitude of the nation.
Well, this is it, Ryan. Exactly, and they've been very busy for the last while. There's been something on.
I read something about it in a paper somewhere. But why your interest in this day?
Well, my mum was a nurse, Ryan. She would have trained in St. Michael's in Dunleary in the late 50s.
Yeah.
Great hospital, as you know.
Yes, indeed. I know well. Pass it by regularly.
During her training, she would have done great things like spiking the doctor's tea with the magnesium sulfate, apparently.
Okay. A messer.
A bit of a messer, yeah. One of the doctors would have been well known to you at the time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but apparently Pat Tuberty was one of the doctors who got no.
That's my father you're speaking about before he headed to John of God's. But the point being that if your mother was spiking my father's tea, well, he was a coffee man.
It's a while ago. Anyway, in the early 60s, my mum got involved with a charitable organisation and went to Vietnam in 1963.
Whoa, what a time to go to Vietnam.
Exactly. So she was about nearly 2 years in Vietnam, working. She went over to set up a leprosarium initially, but obviously got involved a lot with the situation in Vietnam. The government, the South Vietnamese, would seem that the government at the time asked her to go to a place called Quy Nhon, which would have been north of Saigon.
It was the war kind of raging around.
The war
her.
Was on at the time. Yeah, it wouldn't have been as well known in the early 60s. Americans got more and more involved, and as the 60s went on, so it got the news came back more and more about what was going on in Vietnam. Yeah, so it was. Yeah, it was a tough time. She spent a lot of time there dealing with. She would have dealt with a lot of the refugees coming, fleeing the war. Would have been involved in vaccinating a lot of people about from things like typhoid and. All sort of things that we don't really hear about anymore.
Yeah, thank God. Yeah.
Thank God. She would have set up a operating theatre in Quy Nhon and been dealing with injuries and the people. Yeah, so she wasn't involved with the military as such, but because of the war, the military would have been around the place. And I have a picture of her holding a rifle of some sort, because they had to give the nurses all some sort of small weapons training in case they ever had a problem. And I have another picture of her holding this little Vietnamese baby, and on the back of the picture, it has in her handwriting has the baby was delivered by C-section 15 minutes after the mother's death.
God.
So the mother had been shot, and a U.S. Army medic managed to deliver the child and save it, and it ended up in the hospital where my mom was working. Yeah. So.
And the Viet Cong played a part in her story too.
Yeah, she was captured at one stage by the Viet Cong. I don't know how long she was in captivity, but she was ultimately released by, or rescued,
yes.
Rescued by the U.S. military, the U.S. forces, herself and a few other similar nurses and other Westerners who would have been rescued.
So Betty goes from spiking doctor's tea in Dunleary to the jungles of Vietnam to be captured by the Viet Cong and rescued by the US Marines, and we're only in 1966.
And she would have been 23 when she went to Vietnam.
What a story.
So, so she in 19, she came back then obviously in 65. I'm told she was a guest on the Late Late Show at some point in 65.
Oh, that makes perfect sense, yeah.
Yeah, with Gay Byrne. But it was a previous videotape apparently, so I don't think there's any record of it. And then she got the Florence Nightingale Medal in 1967.
Yes, and that's for nursing.
For nursing, yeah. So, and up until only a couple of years ago, she would have been the last Irish woman to have received it. It was about 50 years before somebody else got it. So that was 1967, and then she, in 1969, she was appointed or nominated onto the Irish Commission for Peace and Justice, which was one of these ecclesiastical commissions. I have the minutes from some meeting in Wynn's Hotel in Abbey Street, where the Chief Justice Carola Delic suggested that my mum be the honorary secretary until they get a proper executive secretary appointed. So it's like that was weird.
Yeah, no doubt.
Not what you expect to see. Okay.
She was
on that commission then, and then in 1972 she got married, so had to give up her job because that's what you had to do in 1972 when you got married. 1973, I was born. Good year, as you know.
A great year, Ken. Actually, probably one of the finest years known to.
And the best month as well, Ryan, believe it or not.
Oh, and the same month? What day in that month, Ken?
The first of May.
The first of May.
I'm a few weeks ahead of you.
Congratulations. Happy birthday.
And then a few months later, I stopped breathing and turned blue. And my mum found me in the cot, not breathing, and picked me up and dumped me in the sink, apparently with the dirty dishes, and saved my life.
Oh, Ken Healy remembering his mother Betty on International Nurses Day from the Ryan Tuberty Show. And that's it for Playback Daily, so mind yourself till next time.